It's that's what it comes down to, and that we say fear of death, but really it's just the fear of dissolving. And that was what, coming back to Wilhelm Reich, that's what he was coming up against in terms of people's willingness or ability to really surrender or let go, was the fear of dissolution. So it's really their fear of death translating into embracing life. So people aren't embracing life because they're so afraid of dying, which is like kind of the ultimate paradox, right? But that translates over into everything, because if you're afraid of, if there's a deep-seated fear of dissolution and character armor is being built up all around that to keep that in place, then it translates into all these other fears. And so, and all those other fears are really just excuses for not facing the main primordial essential fear of dissolving into, the void or the infinite or into life. And so he sees how that relates to actual muscle memory, and how the way that you're holding your body is literally an extension of this kind of, knot that's been put in place as a coping strategy. And so that's really Reich's thing in a nutshell. And it's amazing to me that that's even like debated. I'm like, what are you debating? Like, this is so obvious. I don't get it. I mean, you could maybe argue some of the finer points around that idea, but like that idea is essential. And talking about this relationship between, you're saying Orgone and Kundalini, I would say that it's not the same as the distinction between an archetype and a symbol, in the sense that really, we're both cases we're talking about repression. If something's being held at the, in the tantric system at the base of the spine, if you're looking at repression and psychoanalysis, it's really the same thing. Because when we're young and we're amorphously perverse, that's the idea that's being presented, is that all that means is that the energy is flowing, and that the energy in puberty and in development gets localized and pushed to literally the base of the spine. And so you're like, well, that's not that much. It seems to me that they just took that idea from there, and that Freud loved to do that, and that Jung was more open about where he took things from, but that one seems really obvious. I'm like, dude, that's totally not just an Eastern idea, but that's also a Kabbalistic idea. I mean, that's the meaning of the Shekhinah, is that she's literally at the base of the spine. And so, then that's repressed. She's in exile, and then to liberate her is to liberate the energy of life. It's the Shefa. It's the light that's, ascending down the tree, descending down the tree, So, yeah,
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
it.
yeah. And what's interesting about the Reich story as well is really how, society responds to it, right? It's kind of like an Inception type scenario or a Matrix type scenario where once they're onto you, everyone's against you, kind of. Where if an idea is way ahead of its time, you might be seriously ostracized, and depending on how you deal as a social creature, you might come off as actually rather crazy. So his people that were burning his books, and Robert Anton Wilson has written rather eloquently on this subject already, so I'm sure people already know about it. But it's just like this quote unquote scientific community just went completely religious and burned all his stuff, and it's just that fat, like he wrote on the fascist strain of the human mind. And kind of do another 180 real quick. Bill, I was rewatching your interview with Alan right before we got on. I only got through half of it, but the idea of you were talking on ritual and magic circles and, opening those up, and I see synchronicity as kind of like that, where if you're playing the ritual of life in a certain way, it will open up to you. But the question is, like, how do you do that? When do you do that? How do you go about transmuting what comes your way as a result of it? And I was writing to a friend, and I wrote that it's similar to, I guess, one of those B movies where they're playing with these magic, symbols and whatever. They don't really know what they're doing, and then they resurrect the ghoulies or whatever. And they get and it turns on them. And it's like kind of like that, right? In a lot of ways for people. So it just kind of like, whoa, you actually did something right. You unlocked the key, and you didn't even know what you were doing. And all of a sudden, as above, so below, and you're almost like reenacting
Right, or it's
something
like
larger.
Steppenwolf.
So
And you're relating to a reflection of a reflection, and things only relating to the thing in itself. And then you're reacting to that in fear, because you can see its illusory nature, and yet it appears so real. So, like, the end of Steppenwolf, Hermann Hesse, where it's like he stabbed a reflection of a woman with the reflection of a knife, And he's relating to his dream symbolism as if it were an actuality. And really all the dream symbolism is doing is just communicating a higher meaning, but he's taking it so literally that he's not able to receive it. And so he has to repeat the lesson again and again until he's able to remain equanimous to what his mind is presenting him. Because if it's in the mind, it's malleable. It's not to be taken ultimately too seriously. And that's why they're saying you have to laugh. That's actually the message of the book, is that laughing is the transmuter. Laughter allows for transmutation because it's a break in the thinking. You know, you need to be able to, you know, relax into it and not take the mind so fucking seriously. And so,
that's the whole point too, is that, you know, and whenever I'm reading different safe blogs or different people commenting on the stuff, and we've said this before, it's like, if I see no sense of humor, and by extension, no poetry in what is being put out there, I just reject it now completely.
Right, well, I mean, I can get into subliminal synchrosphere big time, you know, even though his ultimate point I completely don't resonate with, you know. He's a fucking genius.
He's his own entity. There's really nobody out there. I mean, he's standing on the shoulders of giants, don't get me wrong. You're talking about a guy who digested a lot of sync work and then took it to another level. I mean, he's adding a ton of his own content, but he doesn't source.
He does a little bit sometimes.
But if he were to resource like everything, like I got this from here, I got this from here, but that's beside the point. I'm just saying that I think that when Reich made his break, or he took it to this other place, it was scary because it wasn't science. It was something resembling science. And I think if you were a hardline science guy, you reject it immediately. But for those who aren't so rigidly fascist about science, they get where he has taken the journey to. And I think that where I'm an instigator too is, you know, when someone's taking things way too seriously, I feel compelled to at least take the stick and poke a little bit. If I were in a conversation with that person, I think the way the poke would occur would be drastically different. And we're talking about, you know, a line of text on Facebook. So it's going to be a little bit more blunt, but I would hope that in engaging that stick poke, a conversation can evolve out of that, that can sort of, it's not talking anyone off of a ledge, but it's getting someone out of a way too serious kind of mindset that is destructive, I think.
So I kind of want to just, here's something else, right? So I'm totally comfortable with the sort of paradox of this, but you're on one respect, you're saying, hey, you've been on a forum, take a year off is so great, right? Because you come back with a fresh mind, which is kind of what I've said for the last year or so is, and the Lawnmower Man reference that I say is that we're absorbing data, but we don't process. We don't process the information. We're just like, we're drinking from the fire hose most days, right? And yet there's also something to be said for occasionally putting your face in the fucking fire hose. And, you know, what is the, expression of psychedelics as load the universe into a gun pointed at your head and fire, you know, it's like it's everything all at once, right? So there's, I guess I'm saying I totally understand this sort of distinction between sometimes you need to fucking step away and process. And sometimes you need to, you know, touch the third rail. I just want to, Bill, like you again, you have this idea of, hey, there needs to be reality checking, and there's this great thing about a chaos lodge is that everyone's on the same level. You're also saying, like, hey, it's great to be totally connected through smartphones, while at the same time saying, hey, it's a great thing to step away and blah, blah, blah. I just want to sort of speak to this, what's a seeming dichotomy, even though I am just, you know, it's as if, would you say it's a time, like, sometimes this is the appropriate behavior and sometimes this, or just appreciating the aspects of both?
See if I can language this or say it without coming off like a complete asshole.
It's cool. It's really we know you're an asshole, so you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, there's nothing to hide.
We already know.
LeClaire said something recently about the Kabbalistic tree of life being a clock.
Yeah, okay. He did.
All right. And that's fine. I mean, I'm not going to... Mark is, you know, top tier. And his work with Fulton on the Moon Room, man, check it out. I mean, it's crackling, man. That's a good time. But my whole thing with the Kabbalistic tree of life is that it's a transistor. And transistors take a little bit of energy and then pass it through another transistor, and it amplifies energy. I mean, it's the seriously most fucked up thing man has ever created, right?
Yeah, man.
I mean, it's what we're talking on right now is all because of transistors.
It's true.
I mean, it's the integral piece of technology that is the foundation for our modern life. So the Kabbalistic tree of life is a transistor. How is this important? Well, it's a transistor in the sense that it can amplify your thinking. David has spoken eloquently, hours and hours upon this, about, resonances and building resonances between things, between ideas. You go from A to B to C. But then that D that you hit isn't on the same line as A, B, C. You jump a level. And then you go D, E, F, and then you jump a level. So what is this whole point of accelerating thought and amplifying ideas? Why do we do this? Well, I think for a lot of people, it's just, I call it fluffing the stone. It's, you've got the philosopher's stone. You don't know what the fuck to do with it. You can recognize it, and it just feels good. But the thing is that you want to amplify your thoughts. You want to jump levels in your thinking so that you get to a certain breakthrough experience. And so what? Okay, so Kubrick, Sync forums, Sync books, podcasts, all this stuff is out there to give you a stockpile of information. And then you run that through your transistor to make connections to get through to a breakthrough experience. What is that experience? I'm not here to tell you what that is or what it means or what it's about. But I think that the model with which I'm presenting is pretty simple and pretty agreeable. I think that if you're doing this work all the time and you never take a break, then you have to think about, maybe my transistor isn't functioning correctly. Why am I not getting to 88 miles per hour? Because that's what the DeLorean's for, is we built this machine, we got to take it to 88 because then it does what it's supposed to do. And I think McKenna says that the whole point of this is you break through, and then the whole goal is to bring something back. You bring something in the form of artistic output, or you bring it through some psychological insight, and then you... After you synchronize, you localize. You go there, you bring the thing back, and then you share it with everybody. If we're not bringing the thing back and sharing it with everybody, then maybe we're not getting there, or maybe we're being too selfish, or maybe we're abusing the equipment. I don't know. Okay. So So I'm not keeping time with these models. I'm building scaffolding so that the rocket can go to the moon and come back with the moon rock, whatever that is. And so that's my whole thing, is that, like, my Kubrick Transformer Always Record involvement in SyncBook, that was what I brought back the first time. Or you know what I mean? Of all that 20 years before, what I brought back was, you know, this DVD that I, and this formula I sent out to the world, these shows I've done with you, the chapter I did in SyncBook, that's what I brought back. And now I have to, well, I feel like I'm working on bringing the next thing back.
It's like Dr. Seuss's Unorthodox Taxidermy, where he's got these crazy creatures. He's like, I went on a fucking psychedelic safari, and I was in this crazy place, and I actually have proof, and it's fucking on my wall, because I fucking shot this crazy fucking beast. You guys know what I'm talking about?
No, but
sure,
I think I talked about it at some point with you guys, because I think it's hilarious, but it's that principle of, and you know, Joseph Campbell talks about it in, I think, The Power of Myth, where, you know, it's kind of like this, what is it, El Dorado, where you go to this crazy place that's super unknown, you know, it's uncharted, you know, and you go to the psychedelic place, and you're like, oh, but I brought back proof, and you're like, I was here, this was real, and that's a lot of the time what some of these synchronicities are, is like, if somebody wants to take the time to go down that rabbit hole, you have something to, like, show for it. You're like, no, this was a fucking crazy place, and this is what happened, and here's the evidence for it. John, do you think you could speak a little bit on what you posted in terms of positive feedback? Because I think that that's really applicable.
Oh, yeah. So in certain systems, when, like, usually they're called oscillators when you really take a reductionist model of this. When they reach some kind of, like, sympathetic resonance with each other, some kind of feedback where there's distribution of, like, A to B or B to A,
mm-hmm.
positive feedback is the growth side of that equation. So when you're getting lots of positive feedback, it's growing, 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 growing. Now, that's obviously, there's limits to all growth, right? And then negative feedback comes in and creates the stabilizing force that limits the positive feedback. So there's all this, like, ebb and flow and give and take. And so you guys were just kind of alluding to that in the prior discussion. So it just, I linked this to somebody yesterday, and it struck my memory.
Yeah, it's almost as if there's a double torus taking place in terms of Dionysian positive feedback and simultaneously an Apollonian positive feedback, and that that sense is like, yeah, you have two things that are mutually interdependent, but even within those two things, there's mutual interdependence in terms of exponential growth as long as the empire is continuing to expand.
And the interdependence is actually, in a lot of ways, what creates the negative feedback, right? So it's a give-take. So when you have two systems coupled with each other, there has to be that, right? So, yeah, there's growth, but inherently, the more coupling that happens, the more distribution that happens, and so there has to be a sharing and a stabilization of that. And I'm sure that happens in many ways. And so, like, society's human relationships, these are all complex systems involving positive and negative feedback. And synchronicity is, it's not as simple as, oh, it's just a positive negative feedback situation. No, but these are elements of it that I've stumbled across and have struck a chord with me and seem, at least, you know, in this very physical base kind of way, gives some description of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, that's why I linked that.
You know, it's like, you know, in the obvious form of feedback is like when you're, you know, have like a microphone too close to a speaker or something like that, you see something getting out of control. I think this would kind of keep, maybe it's just in my mind, but kind of keep speaking to something similar, like when we say the idea of something, you can have growth, but not uncontrolled growth.
Right.
And, you know, this is, you know, again, we kind of connect it back to a lot of the things that we've addressed here today. But I couldn't help but thinking about, you know, as I was just kept thinking with this, okay, we're hitting episode 100, and I just made a joke to David that we had built a Tower of Babel. It was more like a pun, but it really seems kind of really ingrained in it as well. And I'm just curious, David, I know you've spoken about this a number of times, and maybe I can ask you to kind of, how do you see that working into your sort of view of the Tower of Babel and things like that?
Well, it's interesting because at this point, whenever I think of that, I'm visualizing that effect you can do with the Babylonian squares, where you form them into cylinders and one planetary square on top of the next, and how you're setting up a kind of parameter within which to work, and you don't actually extend outside of that, but it's literally directed towards whatever you want to call it, like a zero point, or there's some point at which everything's kind of culminating towards a zenith crescendo, whatever, you know. And in a sense, it's the same principle as orgasm, but it's also what people would relate to as the same principle as moksha, or when strange attractor. Yeah, totally. This is kind of idea, but the point being is that it's designed in order to collapse and then start over. And so when you're looking at what you call positive feedback, it's the exact same principle because it's exponential. So you have an exponential increase of something, and the empires actually express this same phenomenon, right? Is this answering your question, or am I going on a tangent?
Me? No, it's great. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't want to babble. it's more of a principle than it is anything material. It's like, it's a way to communicate something. And when I look at the fact that the whole East Coast of the U.S. is modeled after this principle, and I don't know beyond that, I just know that that's been mapped out and represented, and it was a very compelling, interesting argument that I came across for that. I've talked about it a number of times here, and it kind of blew my mind, the selling of the corporation, you know, like America as a corporation, and that literally we're like a colony of England, but that when we set up the way that the entire East Coast is actually laid out, we like encoded the Babylonian magic squares into the layout of the cities, which is really fucking trippy. It's weird. I found that from a Protestant guy who I don't know if I would, agree with where he's coming from with that, but he definitely did stumble upon something that's pretty fucking far out. And so to say that that's the basis for our commercial enterprise that is America, and that when you look at the implications of that, that basically the whole thing comes down to Mars. I mean, they put a Mars square in the middle of multiple other squares, and it's like, oh, that's what we're going for? Well, shit. You know, it's like, you know, any bumper sticker you see that says America Forever becomes kind of ridiculous. Because the very nature of the thing is an acknowledgement that this is all going towards one point, and that one point is actually the point of collapse. And that's embraced, that's acknowledged, and that's accepted. And it's like, well, this is the cost of what we're doing, you know. It's interesting.
Well, there's an idea that, like, there's these alternative models of how a particle is modeled, and this one idea of the wave model is that the wave is attracted to the center, okay, so this kind of like strange attractor point. And quantum waves are attracted here, and then they hit the center, and then there's this sort of inversion that occurs, and a ripple that was once going inward is now going outward, and this is happening so rapidly and in such a congruence that it looks like a particle, right? So there's this flip at the center, and then it expands back outward. So there's almost, so this idea of the cyclical nature of time or whatever, or cyclical nature of things, yeah, it's cyclical in that it goes in and reverses and expands and completely, it's just like oscillating back and forth and back and forth. But the way these systems work is that, again, I don't think history ever repeats itself perfectly. You're always going to get close, but never to the same point.
That's it. So in that film Enemy last night, they make a really profound statement where they say every event happens twice. The first time it expresses itself as a tragedy, the second time it presents itself as a farce. In other words, it's an imitation of the initial thing, which is really kind of trippy if you consider, like, birth of tragedy idea, but that the first thing that came to my mind was the fucking temple. because I'm like, oh, well, the temple, obviously, the first time it got destroyed, total tragedy. The second time it gets destroyed, it's like, oh, we remember that tragedy. Let's contrive it. Let's make that happen again in order to produce the same effects. And it's the same principle as the King Kill ritual. It's usurping power. So you're like, okay, well, these people have this power. It's at least in the belief system, it's very real. And then we take on that power by destroying it. We, you know, this is the same idea as any empire conquering another empire. It's that you're literally usurping the energy from what you're building on top of. And America is a really poignant example of that. You know, I mean, we kill off what's here, and then we're taking on the energy of what was here before us. And this was the basis of our obsession with, you know, The Shining and Poltergeist and stuff. It's like, or at least mine, is that that's the idea, is that we're building on top of something, and what it is that we're building on top of is actually like seeping through us and like running through us. It's like it's in us, you know. Dinosaurs didn't die, they're roaming us right now is the idea, you know. But I don't know, I find it really, really interesting, the idea that when the everything coming together to build this thing, when it collapses, it disperses, and we build a bunch of smaller things, which eventually come back to try and build the larger thing again.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, so imagine like a bacterium or something, right? Wow. They don't even know the process that they're working towards. I'm not saying we're that low of consciousness, but I don't even know what it's like to be a bacterium, so who the fuck knows, really? We just have all these ideas about what and is not. And that's just crazy to think about, absolutely.
Yeah. There was a point that Baruch wanted to make. You know, there's this idea where we might, it's quite possible we'll do like a little video series on Kabbalah. And instead of just...
He already sent me the first script, actually.
Do you read it?
No, it's on my screen to do after this call. Yeah.
Okay. Well, he read it to me over the phone the night before last. And actually, I met with him yesterday, and I was talking to him about it, and a couple of the points that he made are really crucial, and one of them being is that, first of all, when you're relating to the tree as a representational model, it's not the fucking tree, it's a replication of the tree, and that's so obvious, but it should be understood, you know. But one of the things is, when you're looking at that, what's called the lightning flash, we see it in this two-dimensional way, and he's emphasizing that it works the same way that a galaxy works, where you have the central sun, like Tiferet, and then everything is actually spiraling around it. It's this whole, everything's attracted to the center, but it can't get to the center, because to get to the center would be its own dissolution. And so it keeps perpetuating itself by trying to get back there, in the same way that all the planets, you know, with their gravitational force or whatever, are actually spiraling through space. There's a big spiral, and there's a spiral within the spiral, because they're spinning simultaneously. But that the spherot, and thus the shefa, the light that's coming down, that's actually the life force of the thing, is actually doing the exact same process. And that's the best way to understand it, actually. But that we're moving through space, but we are just like Curly used to say, every man and woman is a star. It's that idea, you know, but in this case, it's more like every man and woman is a planet, you know, because we're...
Or like drops of water on the spider web, right? It's the same dynamics at play, the exact same thing. It's crazy.
It's us. It's that we're, yes, drops on the spider web, far fucking out, but that we're composed of, you know, it's not just as above, so below. It's that within every part is the same dynamic expressing itself, no matter how microcosmic you want to get or macrocosmic you want to get, is the same principle of the dynamics of the vacuum that are at play. And that literally, it's just like in Poltergeist, when it's talking about the beast and it's saying she's attracted to her because of her life essence, and it's trying to get it, but it can't have it. It can't, that thing that's trying to wrap itself around it will never actually reach it, but it tries nonetheless. And so it encircles it. And this is the idea of the cleat boat, which is literally our perceptions of the world, is that we're literally trying to get to that light. But as this, we never reach it. We just follow it into infinity. You know, it's like kind of the ultimate kind of fractal matrix, you know, thing. But it's literally that it's like a strange attractor, like you were saying. Kind of crazy. I mean, what's the principle of the strange attractor, John?
Well, the way it works, that usually in any kind of traditional Newtonian system, you would think that a system evolves according to its initial conditions. Like, you start a ball at the top of a hill, it's going to roll down to a fixed point. It's pretty much 100%. But with a chaotic system, when enough elements are introduced in these quote-unquote web dynamics take over, then initial conditions, like, you can have the same initial conditions, and it almost doesn't matter, because those 2 points, say you have 2 points at what you think to be the same initial conditions, they'll diverge in quote-unquote chaotic ways, but they'll also zero in towards an attractor instead. So it's almost like they're pulled from the future instead of rolling from the past, if that makes sense.
Right. It's like, so chaos is undeciphered order.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, chaos is a misnomer. It's part of the reason the science has become so obscure. I like it in that it's edgy, but it's also totally stupid to call it chaos, because it's not. It's just complex order or web dynamics.
You're right. That's, we really should call it chaos.
Call it what?
Chaos.
There's a term from Finnegan's, which I still have not read, Finnegan's Wake, that I plan on, chaosmos, and I love that word. But at the same time, yeah, I'm shitting all over chaos. But anyway, that's the difference between, or what the essence of the attractor is. So it's almost like flipping dynamics, not entirely on its head or anything, but it's doing something not yet fully understood.
It's an acknowledgement of relativity, right? It's like no matter how far we move from home, the universe remains our center, or something like that. Or that there's a center that we're in relationship to, and the further you move away from it, the more chaotic things appear. Yet ultimately, it's just beyond our scope, because we're still moving towards something, even though it's unaccounted for. Is that kind of the idea?
That's an interesting lens to see it through. Like, I'm stupid when it comes to relativity. I know it, right? But I'm horrible at philosophizing with it. So I usually rely on like quantum theory in that sense. If I'm talking about an event horizon, which it sounds like you're kind of talking about, where there's this blurriness, right, between point A and point B, between the initial conditions and the attractor, where there's all this novelty in between, right? So you'll never get the same situation twice. That's history. That is the cyclical nature of things. So yes, repeats, but not repeats. And it's just, it's interesting to see that there's hints of what is really going on in so many schools of thought. So whatever you're into, you can find hints of it. I don't always think, like, pop culture has its place, right? But it's also at the same time expressed by misgivings. It's like, but what isn't pop culture, I guess? But it's like, I don't know. Anyway.
I'm just tripping out because I feel like it was possible that, I'm sorry, I'm chewing, I'm terrible.
That's cool.
I think it's tripped out the way that, you know, have an event happen, a celestial event. Even like, you could make the argument that the Big Bang, which is ultimately happening now, in the midst of that, we're imitating the Big Bang, and it's contrived. Sure. And so,
well, what's really funny about modern science is that they still have pulled the Big Bang, but they really don't believe in a starting from nothing hypothesis. It really is an ether kind of static universe model that with eruptions happening all over the place, kind of. So they call it like the Higgs field, right? That is the new ether. And now we have a merger of Big Bang and static universe models, but no one really acknowledges what's really going on. But that's really what is. So there is this acknowledgement of just a bottom point of reality that has no explanation yet. They say they can explain everything. And then there's all this hypothesizing about what that essence is, or that Godhead is. It's the scientific Godhead. Right. I love the Discordian text, because they occasionally will speak on the scientists and kind of poke fun at the scientists and how they make direct connections between the scientists and the magicians and the wizards. And it really is a direct, historically provable connection that has never left us. And science is so mixed with that in Judeo-Christianity that it's strange, the dogma that they've settled on. And so few of them actually tackle synchronicity, which is pathetic, actually. But it was so fun to talk to David Peake, because then he got into Pauli, and it was cool to know his connections to that. And there really is this huge really body of work on the subject that it is serious. It's playful, but it is, you know, there's a serious side to it that can be studied and is very academic and real. And so anyone that pursues it, I think, is a genuine like scholar and someone that should be, yeah, supported in that work.
Yeah, that was ridiculous. I couldn't believe that we got to talk to him. Honestly, like, it was pretty crazy.
Yeah, he was what I was hoping. He's a cool guy. And Alan, like you said, it was interesting because, yeah, he just wanted to focus on the metaphysics, and isn't that really what it's about? Because that is the intersection between the logical side and the illogical side, or the magical side and the external projection side.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that he made a statement about concerning synchronicity, that it's oftentimes, if you have what was the man's name? Polly?
Wolfgang Polly, or Pally, I don't know, there's all kinds of fucking names.
His room number at the time of his death?
Right, it was 23, it wasn't 237, but Alan, I don't know if you remember.
No,
it was 137?
137? Yeah, I think
137, because it's the same thing, isn't that's a quantum enigma, is 137?
It's called the fine structure constant. It appears in all these equations and kind of like, yeah, foundation work.
Right. It's the value of the word Kabbalah, which is the one that just got me. I was like, whoa.
Yeah, that got him too. Like, you could tell, like, that was one of the things that got him. He did not know that.
So are you saying that this number 137 is like a strange attractor that was embedded within physics and quantum physics so that it would have to be looked at and at least partially attempted to explain?
Kind of, sort of. I think this was talked about on the first time I ever came on this show. That you see things or numbers pop up because they represent... Like, I don't think numbers are primary as much as numbers are just a language for expressing something. You know, just the way when I put pen to paper and write something, it's a language. It's expressing a process, a deep process. And so the 137 is a common iterative or repeating happening going on at a deep, deep level, right? The synchronistic level that we can't necessarily know entirely. And yeah, I don't know if I answered that.
Well, numbers like 137 is a ratio of 1 over 137, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So, but they just refer to it as 137.
Yes. Yeah.
It probably, oh fuck, what was it? It's got a, I did a post about this. The equation encapsulates all of Finnegan's Wake.
That work was motivated by a number of things, but basically the primordial scientific text describing chaos theory from like Newton's time. And then he took that idea and ran with it and said, how can I, in the same way chaos or these kind of systems principles invert Newtonian thinking, how can I invert kind of like the Newtonian English or the Newtonian language conception and turn it on its head? And I think it was largely an effort to do that. And so why it inspires so much hatred and also respect at the same time.
These numbers that are non-repeating, like pi, that just...
Yeah. Yeah.
Why they're such enigmas, right, is that these are real numbers. They are essential to mathematical calculations that exhibit results in the real world. So they're intimately connected to predicting real things.
It's a good language. Yeah, it's a good divining language.
Right.
I'm not saying, but I wouldn't say the world is math. I don't buy that, but go on.
But the thing is that you can write out this whole equation and say, start this here, it will end up in this spot. And the equation says it'll end up in, you know, two paces up and three paces to the right. And then you do the thing and it goes two up, three to the right. So you can predict something that will happen in real time. It's just whatever. But part of some certain numbers in these equations, they exist. So pi, you know, is 3.14, blah, 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 blah. We represent it as a symbol, and we have this number. The symbol is finite, but the number, no one has ever looked upon pi, the number, in its totality. So no,
except for in the movie Pi.
No one has seen the face of God, right? We know it's there.
Yeah.
You write about it, but no one has directly looked at the number pi.
They looked at its back parts, which is what we have. So that was
that's what the symbol would be. The symbol is... You know, we just put the symbol there in its place. We know it's there, but no one's ever even put it in a book and put
it... Was that the distinction David was making earlier between a symbol and an archetype, right?
Right. And this is a
point. Here's a cross. Point. That's Jesus. No, that's not. That's a pointer. It's a signifier versus signified, right?
And that's what the tree of life is. And that's why it's emphasized by Rumok that you when you're looking at the tree, you're supposed to step into the tree. You're not turning around to look at it, because that was the whole point, is that you're not. This is actually, I read this with Baruch a long time ago, where it was emphasizing this idea. And it was like, why? It's like, Moses can only see God's back parts. He can't look upon the face of God. But that, not just Moshe, but that's a philosophical point, that you can only be the thing. You can't look upon the thing. So if you're talking about something real, that's not a symbol, but the symbol is pointing at something real. If you want to get in touch with the reality of what that is, that idea, you're literally... It's like that seems to be the joke of that you're stepping into a mirror, because it's not actually the mirror. The mirror is giving you a representational model of the thing, but the mirror doesn't even exist. There is no such thing as a mirror. You know what I'm saying? Like, all there is this. Like, you're it. So why would you turn it around to analyze? But
Can I just sort of point out here is... Zenor from Group Name for Grape Juice, right? He did a post. He did two posts, and I think he's been on the show. He's mentioned, discussed it a little bit, but he did a post called 730 Cockpit 731, and then another post called 137 Tip Cock, which is just cockpit reverse. This is the idea of, you know, where he talks with these things. This is, if someone wants to look this up, it's from August 18th, 2013. It's such a great blog. I can't recommend this blog enough. Group Name for Grape Juice. Anyway, he talks with this sort of, David, you're talking about this idea of mirroring something, right? So he's talking about the relationship between the 731 and the 137. And of course, for myself, I have my own obsession with this number 317. You know, so when I'm sort of at this point leaning towards what Bill was saying, is almost like the strange attractor. There's something there that if you want to come at it from the mythological perspective, the 317 will call you. You want to come at it from the physics perspective, the 137 will call you. You want to come at it from the political perspective, the 731 will call you. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it doesn't matter a mirror. It's the same. It's if you're looking at it from different sides, but it's that same sort of calling card. It's the same
cosmic anagrams, you know.
Yeah, but basically for this, I was saying, like, the quantum enigma is the thing to be like, something here doesn't fit, and it's like that little. It's the chicken in the movie. Bill, that is the thing that I have most. I hope you take this as the compliment it is. It's the thing I've most appreciated about your contribution to my consciousness is the chicken in the movie.
Well, that nobody notices?
Yeah.
That's there and nobody sees? What's that? I can't.
It's just the most explicit, dumbfounding thing in McLuhan's work is just how basic... that media is language and it needs to be learned, is that they showed this film to these tribal villagemen in Africa how to sterilize drinking water, right? And they made this movie to show them how to go to the well and to take the water and heat the thing, and they show this movie to them, and the only thing that the people in watching the movie saw was a chicken. And the people who made the movie go, well, there's no chicken in the movie. And they went back and watched it, and they're like, there's still no chicken. And then they watched it one more time, and a chicken shoots out in the lower right-hand corner for, like, less than a second. But that was the only thing presented to them that they could process and that they could relate to.
That's what they could relate to, yeah, totally.
But just their eyes literally could not take in what was on the screen. Physically, there was a biological thing there that they hadn't... That's the whole magic eye. It's the inverse magic eye. Instead of seeing a little bit behind the image, which is what you do with a magic eye, with film you see a little bit in front. So the whole point about seeing film is that you're not seeing it, you're reading it. And when you are constantly reading things, you lock in your eyes, and that's that whole thing.
So
fucking crazy.
Totally. So question, I'm just looking at things here, and I can't help but see that a post that Ridley Scott is supposed to produce a miniseries on Jack Parsons, and then I get something on my wall that says Ridley Scott to produce a miniseries of 3001, Final Odyssey. Is it both?
Yeah.
He's doing both?
He's doing both, yeah.
He is fucking purposefully connecting...
I know, they were announced like
2001 to fucking Jack Parsons. Are you?
They were announced a few days apart. Exactly. Yeah.
No shit. And so the fucking dude, this is crazy. This is, I was so hesitant on the last line of my SyncBook article to fucking point out that I was like, everyone saw fucking Horus at the end of 2001, but they didn't, because they didn't realize that that's what they were watching. And I don't know how true that is, but I fucking just felt so pulled to write that. I was like...
Say that again?
This idea that what you're looking at as the Star Child is actually Horus at the end of 2001.
But you said that everyone says that they see it?
No, that this is what everyone saw, but they don't know that they saw it.
Oh, okay.
And so it's just funny because I was very hesitant to write that because I don't know how true it is. But it just felt right to me at the time, and I just fucking ran with it. But it just it you get what I'm saying in terms of his applicability, because that was Jack Parsons' whole deal, was the fucking the age of Horus, that we're in the age of this, the infancy of you know, where our senses are just coming to awaken. And if you look at, you know, 2001 with the shutting down of Hal, crossing the abyss, you're obviously, like, as far as I'm concerned, that whole movie, you're just moving up the tree of life. Jack Parsons' whole deal, it's fascinating. Because those are so ridiculously compatible and seem to be about the same thing. In my eyes, anyway, the fact that Ridley Scott is doing both at the same time, boom.
Yeah.
Like, seriously.
And this is something one of my own favorite sort of discoveries, and I can call it a discovery. This is, this I can only say is a fucking vision. I mean, very literally, I wrote about how this vision came to me. Anyway, if you look, there's a program that is free to download. Anyone can download online. It's a program called Stellarium, which is basically like a virtual... what the fuck do you call it? You know, you can do the sky, like sky watching programs. You can put any date, any time, any geographic location. You can put your coordinates, your global coordinates. You can go to a certain date. You can see, it's a beautiful program, number one. It's great to, in another sense, to, you know, we learn about these different esoteric schools. It's a really great teaching tool for where you are in relation to space around you. It's actually a really, Goro Adachi uses this a lot and stuff like that. Anyway, I had this realization. There is a, you can turn on constellations. You could just look at the sky, or you can turn on different constellation maps. And there is an Egyptian constellation map, what the Egyptians saw as different constellations. And if you turn on, so download Stellarium, it's a free program, it's beautiful anyway. Turn on your Egyptian constellations, then put in the global coordinates for ground zero. Set your date and time to September 11th, 2001, at the time that the buildings collapse, and look straight fucking up.
Right.
And basically, at the exact moment on the morning of September 11th, as the buildings are collapsing, you look up, and the constellation of Horus is at the zenith point, meaning directly, exactly, straight above the spot of 9/11. So
right.
When we talk about the idea of an ushering an age of an Aeon of Horus or all this sort of stuff, like, it is so exacting. And then, of course, that's over the 2001 monolith, right? The Millennium Hilton monolith. So he's literally rising over the monolith site.
Right.
It's there.
I couldn't help but think of that scene on the moon with the feedback loop when it pierces their ears, you know, and you're looking. It's been considered by Rob Agger that you're literally looking at you're looking into the monolith to watch it. You're looking at monolith face the other way. It's when he's tilting his head to take the picture, right? Or he's doing a whole thing where he's turning the camera, and so it's like it's as if you're in the thing watching the thing, but the thing is turned, and so it creates this feedback loop. But you could also argue that if you're looking at 2001, it's kind of like the crescendo of this culture, and if you're talking about positive feedback, like here I'm looking at positive feedback in mechanical design causes tipping point or over center mechanisms to snap into position, for example in switches and locking pliers. Out of control, it can cause bridges to collapse. So there's this idea of where you have positive feedback, you know, becomes exponential and can turn into a negative situation.
Yeah.
But if you're looking at that film as a kind of a metaphor for kind of this zenith of culture in terms, empire sense, it's like thing, you know, in the same sense that Apollo means destroyer, right? So you have order reaches a certain point, and then order turns to chaos when its growth is exponential. And so when I'm watching that film and I see that that's what's happening with their cover story, they're like presenting this cover story to the public, it's kind of like at which point has the growth become too much? And that's actually symbolically what could be being expressed. You guys follow
yeah.
that?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. Yep. Interesting.
Bell.
Yo.
Okay, what do you got?
Well, I think Alan, you know, the Egyptian constellation right over the Twin Towers at the exact fucking moment.
Mind fuck city.
No, right. How can we even sit here and just kind of keep talking? I mean, it's everything all at once forever right there. I mean, how do you explain that? I think what the whole point is the whole indifference is that the universe could give a shit that that constellation of stars was above that piece of land at that time. Universe just kept on rolling, didn't even blink an eye. But we as human beings, when we're presented with that, we are forced to say, well, let's dig, let's find out what's happening there. If you just told that to some 21-year-old kid who has no idea who Horus is, you know, there's indifference. But maybe the 9/11 hook gets him in, and I don't know. I mean,
it's an initiated perspective. You're not just going to get that. Yeah.
Right. So the explosion or implosion, however that makes you feel, if you're initiated, I mean, that's some heavyweight fuel, right? You can go around the universe a couple of times with the energy that nugget can unleash in you. But that's a fuel source that you have to be initiated fairly in-depthly to get what's there, right? You have to have a flux capacitor to run that fuel. Without it, you just got some stuff that makes you sick.
Totally. Yeah, no, I'm cracking up right now because I'm looking at the Wikipedia page for positive feedback and scrolling down and looking at audio and video systems can demonstrate positive feedback. If a microphone picks up the amplified sound output of loudspeakers in the same circuit, then howling and screeching sounds of audio feedback add up to maximum power capacity of amplifier will be heard as random noise is re-amplified by positive feedback and filtered by the characteristics of the audio system and the room. I like it that it's then howling. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But here at the end, it talks about Jimi Hendrix using developed the controlled and musical use of audio feedback in electric guitar playing. But then it goes on to say the video feedback effect was used in the opening sequences to the first 10 series of the television program Doctor Who. I tripped the fuck out when I saw recently that the first episode of the first season of Doctor Who happened the same day and year that Kennedy was shot, which is interesting then that the first Beatles album to be released in the U.S.
It's not the same year. It's the same day and year.
The same day and year. And the same day and year is also the first Beatles album in America. And then the 5th year anniversary was the White Album. They released the White Album on January 22nd, 1968, I guess. So that's pretty crazy. Just saying. Because in a sense, I really feel like there's a similar phenomenon to feedback, at least like symbolically, when you're looking at things that have such a strong resonance together. They're not the same thing, but they hold such a strong resonance that it comes across as a feedback loop because each component is playing off of each other. If I watch Rosemary's Baby with the White Album, I feel like I'm experiencing a positive feedback loop in a sense because I'm going back and forth between the two items, and that energetic seems to create a certain crescendo that only exponentially builds and reinforces itself dramatically.
Would you also say that the Apollo Dionysus sort of pairing gives a similar sort of like feeding off each other?
Yeah, because of the mutual interdependence. And if it reaches a certain, if one thing is playing off of each other, they're playing off each other back and forth, and it increases in rapidness to the point where it's like this simultaneous recognition. Yes, that feels like it has a huge element of that. And so obviously, JFK is like the kind of spokesperson for Apollonian, expression at the time. I mean, he's, kind of the spokesperson for, I think we should go to the moon. It's like, and then of course, just to repeat, even though we're all probably aware of this, is that Aldous Huxley died at the same day as John F. Kennedy on LSD. And he, as far as I'm concerned, was one of the, chief representatives of the Dionysian culture at that time. And so that's very poignant. I mean, kind of blows my mind a little bit.
And then also dying that day is C.S. Lewis, who wrote about not only the like sort of Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass line, The Witch in the Wardrobe, but literally took the symbol of Christ and made him the Lion King.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Totally. Absolutely. And that plays into all kinds of stuff. I mean, the lion's mane with the rays, and what I can't get over what MGM did with their lion with the poltergeist sample. You know about that? I told you about that.
That's
you know
bizarre.
What I'm talking about? So Industrial Light and Magic came up with a sound riff to communicate the beast in Poltergeist, and for the next 20 years or whatever, every time the MGM lion roared, they used that sample. And obviously, you have trademark, you can't buy or sell without the mark of the beast.
Oh, wait, you're saying it's the other way around, is it was made for Poltergeist first, and then MGM made it the rule?
Yeah. And it was used after Poltergeist, they used it every time. Because it was just the roar that they came up with for the fucking beast in the movie, and then they proceeded to use it. From my understanding, I remember looking this up and it tripped me
out.
Isn't that weird? And so you're like, okay, art for art's sake, in Latin, written above them, I think art, I think temperance, personally, but just that on an aside, you're obviously looking at a symbol of the sun, and then the sun, the beast is symbolic of the Babylonian sun square. And then you're just it feels so direct to me. It's just ridiculous. It's the if you're watching the film Poltergeist when she's at the door and there's that crazy fucking creature that's like made out of fiberglass or whatever that's all like and it roars. It makes this sound. That was the MGM lion roar for years to follow. And they say in the film they're like to her it's just another child, but to us it is the beast. And so they've already connected the beast with that, and then they use that sound. It's so fucking weird. Even when they had different lions, they still use the same sound.
And I get real quick, I guess not to make this about me, but just to go back to your general concept of setting up like a resonance between two things, right, and seeing what you get back. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping to have the new show release this week, but my idea, one of the minor motivations for me to have like two interviews per week was to kind of establish that. So the agenda was not to have like a script to say, okay, we're going to talk about this and hope to create sync. Really, I'm just like, okay, maybe I can line up two people whose headspaces seem like they're in the same space, or my interest in both of them comes from a similar source. And then see kind of, yeah, how that feedback builds, and then like where the conversations meander and don't meander, and how that shapes each one sort of in the mind of whoever's listening. So I'm hoping I get to play with that in a very small way. But that is like a very interesting way to explore the phenomenon itself and to set up a ritual if you want, you know, just a small little fun practice you can do in whatever you create or whatever you're into, I guess.
So I'm going to do a little exercise with you guys here that I did with John the other night. I was pointing out some things. Now, none of this is intentional. I guess one of them is intentional. If everyone can go to thesyncbook.com and then click on the books button.
Move over once, move over twice. Come on, baby, don't be gold as ice. She does. Ooh, she does. Yes, she does. And if somebody loved me like she does, ooh, she does. Yes, she does. She done me good.